This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we speak with really the moral philosopher Chris Hedges, the journalist, on his new book, The Greatest Evil is War.
And stay tuned, and in the interview you'll understand why that is so sadly true. We're also joined by attorney Noel Hanrahan, who will give us an up-to-the-minute report on the current effort to free the political prisoner Mumia Abu-Jamal.
She had attended the hearing and was driving from the hearing to the prison to report personally the situation back to Mumia.
Stay with us.
I'm New York City attorney and author Michael Stephen Smith.
And I'm Jim Lafferty, a decades-long political activist and once the national director of the National Lawyers Guild.
The United States has been at war almost continuously over the last 80 years. Chris Hedges has titled his latest book, The Greatest Evil is War. He's our guest today. What's the driving force behind this nearly a century of war? Who's responsible? What are the institutions in the United States that carry it on? What forces in our country can stop the slaughter and the constant waste of resources that is consuming us and threatening us with the possibility of nuclear war, which would wipe out life on the planet? Today, we will explore the economic, institutional, and ideological underpinnings of the American war machine. We'll talk about the military-industrial complex about which Eisenhower warned us. We'll talk about its handmaidens, the media, the Congress, the universities, and the think tanks which advocate for war. We'll talk about the political consequences of permanent war and the fascist direction America is increasingly going on. Most profoundly, we'll talk about capitalism and fascism from which it springs. And finally, we'll talk about the social forces necessary to stop and reverse war. Chris Hedges joins us in our discourse. He was a war correspondent for 2 decades in Central America, the Middle East, Africa, and the Balkans. For 15 of those years, he worked for the New York Times, where he was awarded the Pulitzer Prize. Chris Hedges is the author of 14 books, including his just published The Greatest Evil is War. We'll talk about this unflinching indictment of the horror and obscenity of war. Chris Hedges, welcome back to Law and Disorder.
Thank you.
You've written in your new book, The Greatest Evil is War, that it was terrible for you having to revisit what you saw, what you went through yourself. Why did you force yourself to write this book?
Because this book didn't draw on my experience in war, as my first one did, War is a Force That Gives Us Meaning. It drew on the experiences of others. And I certainly was intimately familiar with many of these experiences. But I didn't have to resurrect my own memories and put them down in writing. I'd already done that. The impetus for the book was the kind of nauseating intoxication that gripped much of the country following the Russian invasion of Ukraine, as if the war once again was some great sporting match, as if this was a kind of confirmation of American virtue and prowess and might, and very similar to the mood that gripped the public at the inception of the invasion of Iraq, which I very publicly opposed. And this is a kind of giddy embrace of war by people who don't have to go to war. And by people who don't suffer. It's the Ukrainians and the Russian conscripts who are paying the price. Ukraine, of course, is being reduced, large sections of it, to rubble. And I think also because I had been in Eastern Europe in 1989. I covered the revolutions in East Germany, Czechoslovakia, and Romania, and I was there when promises were made to Moscow to Gorbachev not to expand NATO beyond the borders of a unified Germany. We all thought NATO had been rendered obsolete. NATO was formed to prevent Soviet expansion into Eastern and Central Europe, and we now had the president of the old Soviet Union, the new Russia, Gorbachev, calling for security and economic partnerships with not just the West, but the United States. So Henry Kissinger, not one of my favorite public figures, has said correctly, prosecution of the war in Ukraine, the attempt to humiliate, break, and destroy Putin is extremely dangerous and extremely risky. Even the New York Times, in an editorial a couple months ago, said this call for the domination of all territory in Ukraine, including parts of Ukraine populated by ethnic Russians, and I should say ethnic Russians for a couple centuries, is unrealistic. George Kennan, the great Sovietologist, called the expansion of NATO the greatest blunder of the post-Cold War era. And so I think all of those factors led me to want to remind people of what war is, that war is not politics by other means, as Clausewitz famously said. It is about the destruction of all systems that sustain life, familial, environmental, political, cultural. War is an instrument, purest instrument of death.
Well, certainly, Chris, anyone reading The Greatest Evil is War, your book, would come away, I think, with a much deeper understanding that war truly is a horror, an obscenity, that it is, as you say, demonic, really. You write about what it does with civilians and children, women slaughtered in the war. You write about, well, soldiers, their suicides, what happens to their families and so forth. Talk a bit about these others. That's what this book is about, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, I kind of stripped it down to war's essence. When the bodies come home, the wounds that never heal, where I spend time with by this point he's a quadriplegic, he can't even hold a pen, Thomas Young, who had announced that he was wounded in Iraq, that he was going to unhook his feeding tube and commit suicide, but he wanted to write a last letter to Bush and Cheney, so I wrote it as he dictated for him, which is all in the book. I write about corpses, a woman, Jessica Godell, who was in the Marine Corps in the Mortuary Affairs Unit, processing the bodies of dead Marines, young dead Marines, being shipped home. I write about orphans in the chapter on a friend of mine who was a survivor of Auschwitz. She was a 14-year-old girl. Her mother died in Auschwitz, and her father and brother were executed in the ghetto. To remind people that the after effects of war color those who were affected for the rest of their lives, and they're often kind of pushed out of public view. My uncle fought in the South Pacific in World War II, was wounded, came back to a small town in Maine, and drank himself to death with great bitterness about what had been done to him. And he wasn't trotted out for the 4th of July because he didn't read from the script. And if you don't read from the script, the whole idea of patriotism, people are patriots, or people embrace the soldiers, Marines, airmen, anyone else who are patriots only if they parrot back the mythical narrative of war, not if they speak the truth about war.
This is Attorney Michael Smith. I'm with Attorney Jim Lafferty, my co-host on Law and Disorder. We're speaking with Chris Hedges. Chris, you wrote that, quote, the permanent war economy is the root of the two-decade-long quagmire in the Middle East. It's the root of the conflict with Moscow, close quote. This war has been promoted by people you call in a chapter titled The Pimps of War. You believe that, quote, if we don't stop them, they will terminate life as we know it on this planet, close quote. Who are these pimps? What do they represent? And why do they pose a threat of nuclear war and climate catastrophe so big it's even hard to imagine?
Well, I have been dealing with them, and they are, in many cases, the same people since I covered the wars in Central America. So who are they? It was at that time Elliot Abrams working in the State Department with his assistant Robert Kagan, and their job was to discredit what those of us who were reporting were doing, or what the reports were about atrocities being committed by the Guatemalan government under Rios Montt, or the military regime in El Salvador, or the U.S.-backed Contras in Nicaragua. And they were wrong about Central America. They were behind the expansion of NATO, and I think NATO was expanded beyond the borders of a unified Germany for two reasons. One, billions in arms profits by reconfiguring Eastern European and Central European countries to make their militaries compatible with NATO military equipment, and then also the hubris of Washington that after the Cold War saw what they called a unipolar world, which meant complete, total, absolute U.S. hegemony. And these people were behind the calls to invade Iraq and Afghanistan. Debacle after debacle, it doesn't matter, because they are the puppets of the Pentagon and of the defense contractors who fund their think tanks, the Project for the New American Century, American Enterprise Institute, Foreign Policy Initiative, Institute for the Study of War, Atlantic Council, and Brookings Institution. They're like a mutant strain of an antibiotic-resistant bacteria that we can just never get rid of. And they are now fueling this proxy war in Ukraine, which, as Kissinger has pointed out, is extremely dangerous. They're flirting, of course, with a direct or a conflict with Moscow, a major nuclear power. So they're wrong again and again and again. The consequences of the policies they advocate result in horrendous human suffering, 20 years, of course, in the Middle East. And there they pop up on the screens. They never go away. They're never held accountable.
Chris, why don't we talk a bit about the institutional forces in America behind this permanent war that you speak of and write of? Talk to us about various military contractors, the media, its role, think tanks, universities, political parties, of course, the institutionalized forces, as you say, behind this permanent war.
Well, of course, they consume, what is it now, $850 billion, and we just give the military, the Pentagon, vast amounts of resources and taxpayer money. They're not held accountable. They're not audited. They can't be challenged. Even Bernie Sanders isn't going to challenge them. Remember, they make F-35s in Vermont. It's a classic scenario which you see at the end of Empire. Arnold Toynbee and others wrote about it, but you can all go all the way back to Rome, where the Praetorian Guard was auctioning off the offices of the emperor to the highest bidder. They have become an unassailable force, what Karl Liebknecht once called, when he talked about the German military, the enemy from within. And of course, what they're doing is disemboweling the country, because all of our resources, we've given more money to Ukraine in terms of military and humanitarian aid than we spend than the annual budget of the State Department. This is just insane. Just like the Middle East, with no clear goal of what we're doing, where this is going to end up. So that militarism is a kind of classic sign or a classic poison at the end of late empire, where they can't be controlled. And on the one hand, of course, they're destroying the host society in which they inhabit, and the other, they're pushing whatever country they dominate into suicidal folly, and that's what's so dangerous.
Let's talk about internal war in the American capitalist economy. Chris, how do you explain Congress voting for an $800+ billion war budget and then $60 billion more for the war in the Ukraine, sacrificing what needs to be done at home with respect to housing, medical care, education, food, infrastructure? This is crazy. How do you understand that?
Because if you don't support the war industry, you're destroyed politically. The last two national politicians we had who stood up to the war machine were Henry Wallace in 1948 and George McGovern in 1972. In the case of McGovern, a highly decorated World War II veteran, he'd been a pilot. and it was the collusion of both parties. I mean, once McGovern got the nomination, Wallace ran as an independent. But once McGovern got the Democratic nomination, you saw the hierarchy of both the Republican and the Democratic Party join forces to destroy him. There's no daylight between the Republicans and the Democrats in terms of funding the war industry, but none whatsoever. There's no opposition at all. In fact, on most of the major issues, trade and wholesale surveillance and austerity, there isn't much daylight between the two parties. But certainly on the military issues, they're completely captive. Now, we once had, in the 60s or 70s, individual senators or congresspeople who would stand up, at least in terms of cost overruns, or I'm thinking of Proxmire, Fulbright, and others, or wasted expenditures within the military. Even that's gone. There's no oversight in essence at all.
You know, I'm listening and I'm thinking, it's not just permanent war, is it, Chris? It's a pervasive war. I mean, the government reports, our own government reports, indicate that currently the United States is involved militarily or in support of some military in 150 countries and has military bases in 140 or 41 of those countries. And this is highly profitable, is it not, for the military manufacturers in the United States? And, well, is it not also profitable for corporate America in general? Does not our military presence all over the world support capitalism's need for, well, greater and greater empire, greater and greater profits for all of corporate America? In short, is it not fair to say that the United States, as so long as it's a capitalist country and an imperialist country, it's going to be a nation at permanent and pervasive war?
Yes, until the dollar collapses, whenever that is. Alfred McCoy puts a date on it. I wouldn't be so brave. But we know that once the dollar is no longer the world's reserve currency, and there are very active efforts, not just by Russia and China, but other countries in the global south, in Iran, to extract themselves from the tyranny of the dollar, then that will have a devastating impact on the economy and make it very difficult to sustain this kind of global military infrastructure, because the dollars, people won't buy U.S. debt, and number one, and number two, the dollar will decline significantly in value. We know that because in the 50s, the world's reserve currency shifted from the pound sterling to the dollar, and we saw how devastating that was to the British economy.
You've written a very fine book. We urge our listeners to go out and get it. It's called The Greatest Evil is War, Seven Stories Press. Chris, could you please talk about the deep social crisis of late capitalism in the USA today and how this helps us understand the growth of fascism that we are seeing? I recall Bertolt Brecht, the great German playwright and political figure, writing that one cannot understand fascism unless you understand capitalism from which it springs.
Yeah, well, capitalism, unfettered capitalism, Karl Polanyi writes about this in The Great Transformation, accelerates the social inequality, which is, of course, now taken place, the greatest income inequality in American history. When you go back and look at the old oligarchic elite, the Rockefellers, and I think when John D. Rockefeller died, he was worth about $3 billion or something. Now we have figures like Bezos and Musk and who are worth $180 billion. This is just, I think you'd have to go back to pharaonic Egypt or something to find income inequality of this magnitude. And of course, what it does is perverts the entire political system so that it serves the interests of this tiny, rapacious, oligarchic elite at the expense of the citizenry. Aristotle actually writes about this and says that at that point the only two options are tyranny and revolution. And so out of that morass, and I saw it in the former Yugoslavia, because the war in the former Yugoslavia, which I covered for the New York Times, was not caused by ancient ethnic hatreds. It was caused by the economic meltdown of Yugoslavia, which vomited up Trump-like figures, Slobodan Milosevic, Radovan Karadzic, Franjo Tuđman, and others. Go back to Weimar. It was the same there. I mean, the Nazis were polling in the single digits in 1928 after the 1928 crash, and austerity-driven government that actually cut unemployment insurance, although 40% of the insured workforce in Germany at the time was unemployed, then you people reach out for these demagogues, these mutations that promise miracles and of course, solidify right-wing tyranny. Of course, the military remains untouched. The Trump administration is not going to challenge the military-industrial complex any more than the Biden administration or the Obama administration or anyone else. So it is symptomatic of a diseased society where dwindling resources are essentially plowed into a military apparatus that not only doesn't in any way protect the nation, but engages in military adventurism that makes the nation less and less secure. And I think if we look at the 20 years in the Middle East, that's the only conclusion that we can draw.
Well, you know, Chris, I'm thinking here, as you, given all that you've written, given what you've said today, it brings us to, of course, that age-old question, what is to be done? I reflect that during the Vietnam War, a massive anti-war movement in the United States and around the world, for that matter, was put together. It, together with the victories on the battlefield of the Viet Cong, it led to a shortening of the war, the loss of the war by the United States. But it didn't end permanent war. And we don't have a large peace movement today either. What social forces need to be mobilized in order to stop not simply a particular war, which is hard enough to do today, but the interminable war of the United States that you're talking about, the permanent war?
That's a good question. We had, at the inception of the invasion of Iraq, significant protests, and then Kerry, who was going to out Fallujah Bush and reported for duty and all this, it suspended its efforts, in essence, to support a war candidate, I don't think there's any other way to describe Kerry, to get rid of Bush, and it never recovered its momentum after that. But yes, I worry about that. Where's the peace movement? Where's the anti-war movement, which is an important check on militarism? We don't have one.
I think we're coming down to the end of our allotted time here, but I wanted to ask you if there's a part of your book, The Greatest Evil is War, that you might read for our listeners.
Sure. I'll read that last part, the coda that I wrote. I carry within me death, the smell of decayed and bloated corpses, the cries of the wounded, the shrieks of children, the sound of gunfire, the deafening blasts, the fear, the stench of cordite, the humiliation that comes when you surrender to terror and beg for life, the loss of comrades and friends, and then the aftermath, the long alienation, the numbness, the nightmares, the lack of sleep, the inability to connect to all living things, even to those we love the most, the regret, the absurdity, the waste, the futility. It is only the broken and the maimed that know war. We ask for forgiveness. We seek redemption. We carry on our backs this awful cross of death, for the essence of war is death, and the weight of it digs into our shoulders and eats away at our souls. We drag it through life, up hills and down hills, along the roads, into the most intimate recesses of our lives. It never leaves us. Those who know us best know that there is something unspeakable and evil many of us harbor within us. This evil is intimate. It is personal. We do not speak its name. It is the evil of things done and things left undone. It is the evil of war. War is captured in the long, vacant stares, in the silences, in the trembling fingers, in the memories most of us keep buried deep within us, in the tears. It is impossible to portray war. Narratives, even anti-war narratives, make the irrational rational. They make the incomprehensible comprehensible. They make the illogical logical. They make the despicable beautiful. All words and images, all discussions, all films, all evocations of war, good or bad, are an obscenity. There is nothing to say. There are only the scars and wounds. These we carry within us. These we cannot articulate. The horror. The horror. I wander through life with the deadness of war within me. There is no escape. There is no peace. All of us who have been to war know an awful truth. Ghosts. Strangers in a strange land. Who are our brothers and sisters? Who is our family? Whom have we become? We have become those whom we once despised and killed. We have become the enemy. Our mother is the mother grieving over her murdered child, and we murdered this child in a mud-walled village of Afghanistan, a sand-filled cemetery in Fallujah or Mariupol. Our father is the father lying on a pallet in a hut, paralyzed by the blast from an iron fragmentation bomb. Our sister lives in poverty in a refugee camp outside Kabul, widowed, desperately poor, raising her children alone. Our brother, yes, our brother, is the Taliban and the Iraqi insurgent and Al-Qaeda and the Russian soldiers. And he has an automatic weapon, and he kills, and he is becoming us. War is always the same plague. It imparts the same deadly virus. It teaches us to deny another's humanity, worth, being, and to kill and be killed. There are days I wish I was whole. I wish I could put down this cross. I envy those who, in their innocence, believe in the innate goodness of America and the righteousness of war, and celebrate what we know is despicable. Sometimes it makes me wish for death, for the peace of it. But I know the awful truth, as James Baldwin wrote, that people who shut their eyes to reality simply invite their own destruction. And anyone who insists on remaining in a state of innocence, long after that innocence is dead, turns himself into a monster. And I would rather be maimed and broken and in pain than a monster. I will never be healed. I cannot promise that it will be better. I cannot impart to you the cheerful and childish optimism that is the curse of America. I can only tell you to stand up, to pick up your cross, to keep moving. I can only tell you that you must always defy the forces that eat away at you, at the nation, this plague of war. Sometimes I feel like a motherless child, a long ways from home. A long ways from home. It is death I defy, not my own death, but the vast enterprise of death, the dark, primeval lust for power and personal wealth, the hyper-masculine language of war and patriotism used to justify the slaughter of the weak and the innocent and to mock justice. I do not use these words. We cannot flee from evil, some of us, who have been to war have tried through drink and drugs and self-destructiveness. Evil is always with us. It is because we know evil, our own evil, that we do not let go, do not surrender. It is because we know evil that we resist. It is because we know violence that we are nonviolent, and we know that it is not about us. War taught us that. It is about the other, lying by the side of the road. It is about reaching down in defiance of creeds and oaths, in defiance of religion and nationality, and lifting our enemy up. All acts of healing and love and the defiance of war is an affirmation of love. Allows us to shout out to the vast powers of the universe that however broken we are not helpless. However much we despair, we are not without hope. However weak we may feel, we will always, always, always resist.
My goodness, how beautiful, how sad, how beautiful, how hopeful as well. Thank you so much, Chris, for that. If people want to get a hold of this amazing new book of yours, where do they do that? How can people, our listeners, follow your work it should be followed. I know you have many followers, of course, but you need more. We need more people getting on to these kinds of thoughts we've been trying to share today. How do people do that?
Well, all of my columns and shows, which I do for the Real News, people can get on chrishedges.substack.com. Any independent bookseller, please don't use Amazon, you can order this new book, The Greatest Evil is War, from them.
Thanks, Chris. Thank you so much for being on Law and Disorder.
Yeah, really. Thank you.
Be well.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss.
American political prisoner Mamia Abu-Jamal has served 40 years in Pennsylvania's harshest prisons, 16 of them on death row, for the murder of a Philadelphia police officer, which he simply did not commit. The judge who convicted him was overheard promising, and I quote, "I'm going to help fry the N-word," close quote. Mamia is an important figure in African-American history. Before his conviction, he was a nationally carried broadcaster, an award-winning radio journalist, and the head of the Philadelphia Association of Black Journalists. He reported on the murderous racial violence of the Philadelphia Police Department and its notorious police chief and later mayor, Frank Rizzo. He had been a member of the Philadelphia chapter of the Black Panther Party, and while in prison, Mamia has written 13 books and had a weekly radio show live from death row. He holds a master's degree and is working on a PhD in history. On October 26 of this year, Mamia's attorneys appeared in court in an effort to get him a new trial. His defense petition included newly discovered evidence that had been buried in the prosecutor's office. This evidence documented a key witness receiving promises of money for their testimony and evidence of favorable treatment of another witness in a criminal case. The petition also documented the unconstitutional practice of striking black jurors during Mamia's original trial. Judge Lucretia Clemens preliminarily denied his constitutional right to present this new information and evidence. She is likely to finalize this ruling in Philadelphia on December 16th. Well, we speak today with Pennsylvania attorney Noelle Hanrahan. She is a longtime supporter of Mamia and produces the show Prison Radio. Noelle Hanrahan, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thank you so much for having me on.
Noelle Hanrahan, by the way, is, as we speak, on her way to see Mamia Abu-Jamal in prison with news of a court hearing which just took place. More on that court hearing later. But if you notice some distracting noises, that's because Noelle is in her car when we talk to her. You know Mamia. In fact, you know him very well. Talk to us about your relationship with him and what he's like and his family and his accomplishments. Give us a sense of who the man is that we're talking about today.
Mamia is really charming. He's warm. He's wonderful. I've done hundreds of prison visits and really worked with and talked to people over 30 years in prison a lot. And he's someone I really have developed quite a fondness, a collegial welcoming, and a determination to see him free, you know, in a way that is far beyond almost any other relationship I've had. He's an incredible guy. So he's warm, he's funny, he's super smart, he's charming, he's goofy, he walks funny, he has a wandering eye. Oh, I play basketball, and he's 6'1". So first thing I said to him when I met him was, "Yo, dude, what's up? You're 6'1". Can you play?" He's like, "Oh my, no." I was like the last person ever picked for any team. He said he was the most like knock-kneed sort of guy, except he presents. He's 6'1". He's thin. He seems like he could handle the paint, but in fact, he's very geeky. So I like him. I love him. And everyone who meets him is engaged. He's a very engaging guy.
What are the forces aligned against Mumia?
Literally, the Fraternal Order of Police and their fraternal order, which is akin to a union but not a union, It's 1,200 members, 6,500 who are active on the police force currently, majority white police force, who have well-paying, high-paying jobs. And those people who have spent their entire careers really figuring out ways to commodify black bodies. And now, I say that and it sounds dramatic, but it is exactly what is happening in our culture. So, like, over the 30 years of the prison and population boom, you know, this group, this guild, this fraternal order, has figured out a way to use the Juanita Kidd Justice Center as an assembly line of black bodies to arrest. I mean, we have scandal after scandal after scandal of false arrest reports. What they are attempting to do with these massive arrests of poor people or people of color daily is to increase their overtime. It's the overtime bump for coming to court the next morning. So in the Atlantic magazine, Krasner, our DA Larry Krasner, said, everyone knows this is the issue, that our budgets cannot balance because we have an incentive for the police to falsely arrest people and get double overtime. So that's one key thing that's arrayed against them, the system of that, right? Then there's the connection of this jackboot reality, which is Tonton Macoutes or Sons of Rizzo. You know, we need to come up a name for them because definitely they run our culture here. They are in league with the apparatuses of the court and the apparatuses of the district attorney's office prior to Krasner. And so literally, you know, based on fear-mongering and based on false science, John DiIulio, who's now a tenured professor at Penn, his super predator model, you know, based on all of that hype that we went through, those courts and the prosecutors over-prosecuted and targeted people of color. And whether that's an economic capitalist issue, whether that's a Braceros program for the poor, whether that is taking people who need work and jobs and education out of the inner cities when they need to demand, you know, health care and human rights. I'm not sure, you know, that might be higher than my pay grade on the Marx scale, but basically we are living in this environment in which we have a white supremacist police force, which was created by Frank Rizzo and has not changed by much. And we have a court system that is very intense on keeping in place what they know are tainted convictions. They understand it completely, scandal after scandal. And I can go through the scandals. But what are we faced? We are faced with this entrenched, predominantly white, class-based apparatus that really wanted to use poor people for fodder.
Yes. I wonder, too, on the other side, the flip side of that, 40 years now in prison, as we say, certainly this case has been much in the news from time to time. How much support and what kind of support does Mamia Abu-Jamal have through all of this period of time and currently support locally, nationally, and even internationally?
You know, just to show you, when we were able to get Mumia's audio recorded that way back in 1994, and I took it to Ellen Weiss at All Things Considered, I sat in her office and she said to me, we need to hear this material. We are living in a country that is vastly, you know, churning up its incarceration machine, and this is a voice that is part of that dialogue. That was Mumia Abu-Jamal's voice as a new commentator on All Things Considered. The backlash came from the Fraternal Order of Police and others. And so they really went to Bob Dole. He got up on the Senate floor, and he said on the Senate floor that he would threaten National Public Radio's funding if they ever considered producing anything like this ever again. And I was in her office. I flew back to D.C. I was in her office, and she said, I never looked to the Capitol to be censored. This is the first time this has happened to me. He had immense support. He would have reached 7 to 10 million people in South Africa, Hungary, and 570 stations across the United States. That's how big NPR was at the time. So we took the tapes, we went to Democracy Now!, we went to Pacifica, and then I went to New York, and I pulled together his first book and met with Francis Golden to make sure that that book was then available because he hadn't published yet. And I knew there was a media moment Well, and then in addition, I was so angry because, you know, imagine I'm 26. I am a radio reporter. I produce a story for All Things Considered. It gets picked up as a national commentator. And if I don't, and she said to me in the office, just bring me someone more acceptable. And I knew that my career was over. You know, I mean, or the whatever, you know, I mean, these are things that we desire to do, is to be on national radio, but whatever. So I was like, holy Christmas, I am in trouble because this guy is the guy. This is the story. I'm not dropping the story. So I decided to join Equal Justice USA as an organizer and produce Mumia's first book and promote it. And we dropped 350,000 pieces of direct mail, and it became a bestseller. And after it became a bestseller for Addison Wesley, the Fraternal Order Police flew a plane over their headquarters in Reading, Massachusetts, and threatened their textbook division. So he is impactful. And he's impactful because he's a gifted journalist who tells these amazingly beautiful vignettes and was trained in the black newsrooms of Philadelphia when they were fully funded and grew up reporting, and it's just magical. His reporting is magical. He's deeply intellectual, very good researcher, but he tells the human story as well. So he's dangerous to them, and that's why he's still in prison. If he wasn't dangerous, he wouldn't be in prison. He'd be out.
This is Michael Smith. I'm with my former law partner, Jim Lafferty. This is Law and Disorder, and we're speaking with Noelle Hanrahan, who's actually in the car driving to visit Mumia Abu-Jamal to tell him the results of the latest court hearing. Noelle, why did his supporters say that the initial trial was racist?
The judge in the initial trial was Albert Szabo, who has sent more people to death row than any other judge in the country. Many of them have been overturned, his cases. I did a mentorship program when I was in law school with the homicide judge, Barbara McDermott, of the post in the Common Pleas Court, and I asked her, what about this guy? What about Szabo? And she goes, he was the most homophobic, racist, sexist judge she had ever met. Everyone knows how bad he was. So what he did, Albert Szabo, he said in front of a court clerk, Terry Moore Carter, and in front of a sitting Common Pleas Court judge, Richard Klein, I'm going to help them fry the N-word about Mumia in the first week of his trial. Now, later on, now, the reason why the court system, I think, should be really examined is because another Pennsylvania Common Pleas Court judge, Pamela Denby, reviewed that statement and said it was not material because she examined all of his decisions and she couldn't find anything racist in them. This happened a few years ago. So that is not being considered before the court today. So, you know, it's shocking that the level of erasure of evidence, that you cannot cumulatively look at the practice of both the courts. I mean, we're not proving it with any supporters of Mumia. This is a court clerk, award-winning court clerk, and a Common Pleas Court judge who hasn't denied that it happened. But everybody knew. And things like the court also, through the 60-day rule, said that we couldn't show photographs of where the quote-unquote eyewitness cab driver said he was. He said he was behind the police car. Well, 10 minutes after the incident, before the police photographers, the Philadelphia Bulletin, Evening Bulletin, took photos of everything, and there was no cab there. So the main witness they're even talking about today, this guy, Robert Chobert, who wrote a letter to the district attorney saying, I want my money, just after the trial. Now, that's the piece of evidence that the court now is dismissing, in part as not material, and, you know, it's not what doesn't qualify for all the Brady, you know, relief. This guy, Robert Chobert, he was on probation. He was not driving a cab with his current license. He has had a license suspended. He asked the DA to help him get his license back, but he was on probation for throwing a Molotov cocktail in a school for pay. Szabo determined that that information shouldn't be before the jury because it wasn't a crime of crime false. So there's so much about Robert Chobert that he wasn't really there, that he had an incentive to lie to fix his cases, and that he then wrote a handwritten note to the district attorney, McGill, asking where was his money after the trial. The district attorneys now, you know what they're saying? They're saying they're kind of pretending that it was lunch money, cab money, you know, like the $5 a day you get to be a juror, you get to be a witness. I mean, it's ridiculous. Or even if it's an inference, like we get to examine the person who said it, who's still alive, Robert Jobert. We get to talk to them to determine their credibility. But the court initially ruled that it wasn't even material whether they had been bribed. Like, you could bribe a witness and it wouldn't affect any juror in that courtroom? That can't be. So, I mean, these are really basic questions that anyone else would have gotten more of a fair hearing. But Mumia Mal's case, and Mumia is like the third rail here.
Yes. And that brings us, of course, to today and why you're in your car driving up to see Mumia following a court hearing. Let's give some of the background for that. It was recently discovered by Mumia's team that a number of boxes of evidence that should have been turned over to the defense was hidden by the prosecutor in the prosecutor's office. What's in those boxes? Remind us of that again, that would help Mumia. And what is the Brady Doctrine?
So there were two really key pieces of evidence in the boxes that they found. These were found in a storage locker number 17. Larry Krasner literally was looking for a desk table. And he went out down into this locker room that I've seen that has baby carriages in it, junk from the former moves. It was like basement storage unit and just tons of junk in it. And he looks up and he sees boxes labeled Abu Jamal. So he calls an assistant district attorney and says, you got to get down here right now. And they find six boxes. Larry Krasner is not rolling over for Mumia. He's preserving the conviction for a lot of reasons. We can get into that. But he is also not willing to shred the Constitution. And so if you find material that has never been turned over, you should turn it over. The first filing from the previous district attorney was, you just should have believed what the other district attorneys told you, that it wasn't relevant. But that's not the law. So the law is that if you find evidence that has not been previously turned over that would have been favorable to the defense or could have been inferentially favorable to the defense, then you must give it to them and there must be a hearing. And that they're likely it should trigger a new trial. Now, the evidence that we're talking about is, one, the letter from Robert Jobert, a key witness, that says, where's my money after the trial? That there's an inference that his testimony is going to be paid. And so we should figure that out. The second was Brady violation was around, they tracked the other key witness, Cynthia White. They tracked her cases very extensively. There were notes all in her prostitution cases saying, you must talk to District Attorney McGill prior to doing this case. So there's a question about that. Now, there's also mention in there that she's given no special treatment, but that just seems like pretty obviously a cover. But regardless, there's extensive tracking that would not normally appear in somebody's record, and that should be discussed. Whether there was another prostitute, Veronica Jones, who Albert Szabo, when he was called back to sit on the case again in reviewing his own record, he dismissed her testimony as not credible. She testified in open court saying that she was offered the same deal as Lucky, Cynthia White, that if she testified against Mumia, that her prosecution cases would go away. So that also is not before the current judge. So I'm going to help him fry the N-word, and Veronica Jones saying I was offered the same deal as the other prostitute, that is also not before the judge. Another, like, parsing of evidence that doesn't allow you to see the cumulative thing, which, you know, frankly, everybody knows. Like, this is no secret. There's no secrets here. It's Philadelphia. We know what the police did. Oh, when I was talking to Barbara McDermott, the current homicide judge, I'll give you an example. I said, hey, what's up with the homicide clearance rate drop? You know, it's tanking. It's just going through the, you know, what's going on? They're not, like, going after anybody who's committed murder. She said, I can tell you exactly what happened with that. We told them they couldn't tie them to the radiator and beat the confessions out of them. And they told us, we're not going to show up and do our jobs. You want to treat those people? We know they're guilty. You want to treat those people with kid gloves? Here, fine. I'll give them a card for an attorney. That's wow. Everyone knows this. This is not a secret here. So they have a pattern and practice of robbing people. You know, like, people would think I was making this up, but there's, like, three cameras at the bodega, and the cops smash two of them, but they don't get the third, and then they prove that they're robbing liquor stores. Cops are robbing liquor stores. They all get their jobs back, even though the camera shows them doing it, except for one who tested positive for pot. It's like every week there's a new scandaloso that's huge here. It's not unheard of. People know what's going on.
Noelle Hanrahan of Prison Radio, the current judge has already issued a provisional order denying a new trial, which Mumia would win. There was a hearing today to see whether or not she's going to change that order. But the order is very bad for Mumia. Please talk about that.
Normally these orders are orders of dismissal, 907. They used to do them just with a checkbox. They've been, you know, they have to not do that now. So now they have to do it with more. But it was surprising. So she issued a preliminary order to dismiss, and today she did not. She effectively withdrew her preliminary order to dismiss. And in part, that's because we have a fabulous, amazing legal team. It's Samuel Spital from the NAACP Legal Defense Fund. He's the legal director, an expert on Batson. We have Judith Ritter from Widener Law School, who is carrying the Brady claims. And just added was Brett Grody from the Abolitionist Law Center. So this is a fantastic legal team. And I think they did incredible work explaining the law. Like, this is pretty high-level stuff. There's a lot of different ways in which you have to analyze the Brady evidence and also the Batson claim. And I think we did a really, really good job. So the punchline of today is she ordered the other side, the district attorney, to open up more discovery for our side. Now, she couched it by saying, I want to only make this ruling once. But she didn't confirm her order to dismiss. She gave our side more discovery, looking at 32 boxes that had been previously provided to it in a judge's chambers to the previous judge, Tucker, because she wanted us to be able to look at them for Brady and Batson. Now, that's a great hook. It may just be cover. It may be that she's taking 60 to 90 days of when she said she'd make her ruling, 60 to 90 days from now. It may be that, you know, she's just going to adopt, like she did before, the district attorney's procedural time bars, which, you know, her reason for dismissing it this past time was because they were procedurally not allowed to review the merits, that she couldn't even review the merits. But then she did say if she did review the merits, they wouldn't be material. So today, I think in the courtroom, you know, there was a lot going on in the argument. She did not aggressively pursue the district attorney. She was in great dialogue with our attorneys. I think we held up really well. It's encouraging, though not definitive. You know, these courts have been very bad for Mumia for a very long time, and he's got a race against time. He's 64 and in poor health.
Yes. Well, that is some possible good news. And in Mumia's case, given the injustice, the length of time that injustice has been sitting on him, one can be hopeful, but we've seen what's happened in the past. And in fact, it relates to the next question I really wanted to ask you. America claims, of course, not to really hold any political prisoners. Government officials say that people like Mumia Abu-Jamal or Leonard Peltier are just criminals. How do you, Noel, understand the meaning of a political prisoner? And tell us about some of the other political prisoners, perhaps like Leonard Peltier. I mean, your show Prison Radio is wonderful in this regard, but give us a sense of what it really means to be a political prisoner, why the government is wrong when it claims that people like Mumia Abu-Jamal are not political prisoners.
You know, I think just it's easy to put forth that as a mischaracterization or a lie or a consciously developed strategy to criminalize those with political views. There are a lot of people who are in prison specifically because of their viewpoints and have been so in U.S. history. And the easiest thing to say is that the Puerto Rican independentistas were charged with sedition conspiracy, which is a political crime. So I think that, you know, many of the people that we hear from, the intellectuals inside, the people who are writing, the poets, the people who are reaching out over the bars who want to build community, they are politically imprisoned. I mean, we have the highest incarceration rate in the world. It's like one out of 99 people are in actual prison. You know, that's not even counting probation and parole. We have communities that have been devastated and targeted. We all know from Michelle Alexander's work and others that, you know, the Nixon administration targeted the drug wars and they were disproportionately applied. And as I mentioned before, there's an economic incentive for police forces to arrest. And then maybe there's a capitalist component to it as well. So that, I believe, is political. I believe the way in which our culture has been shaped by crime and, in fact, is criminogenic, I think that is political. And so our whole system is based on this decision, this calculated decision to use incarceration as a industrial tool.
Noel, unfortunately, we're running out of our allotted time, but before we do that, Jim and I wanted to ask you, what can people do to help Mumia, and what can people do to tune into Prison Radio?
You know, it's www.prisonradio.org, and there are a couple of initiatives, the Mobilization for Mumia, Campaign to Bring Mumia Home. Wherever you find your home, we've just started Love Not Fear, which is going to expose Mumia's humanity and also police corruption. So people can go to those places. And, you know, anything that someone does matters. Like this tiny little ripple that you create when you throw your rock into the pond or against something else matters, you know. And so I really hope people know that every action matters. And you just never know what the tipping point's going to be or who's going to be affected. But it really does make a huge difference.
I think the example that you've given, over all of these 40 years, there has been, and it ebbs and flows, but there has been a constant awareness that Mumia Abu-Jamal is maybe political prisoner number one. I don't know. It doesn't matter. He's one of them for sure. And the injustice of his incarceration is astonishing, as you've pointed out to us today on the radio. Noel Hanrahan, thank you so much. Thanks for your work on Prison Radio, by the way, and thanks for your work on behalf of Mumia Abu-Jamal. That has been our topic today, and for joining us here on Law and Disorder.
Well, thank you for having me. I really appreciate it.
If you have any comments or questions about this segment or any others, please visit us at lawanddisorder.org.